Hello, I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on Ayahuasca.
It's vibrational wavelengths. You see ayahuasca visions, you see light, you see kaleidoscopic patterns. You become the kaleidoscopic patterns. They're shifting, merging, becoming, riffing, fluid. They're alive. It's like the brainwaves of God. Every memory, every cellular awareness, every emotion, every thought, every ounce of your being is melting into the Godhead as the wave fronts overlap. And you are filled with joy and grace and beauty and knowledge and it. Sounds come out of you, and the sounds help you navigate through the space and become the space. Each word contains a vibrational harmonic essence. This is like 10-dimensional language. It's the language of the spirits.
Yes, for Rak Razam, the experience of ayahuasca is about vibrations and sound and the language of spirits. For scientists like Dennis McKenna, plants like ayahuasca are literally emerging from the jungle because they have a very important message for our species. For Leonard Clare Cunningham and Tom McKinnon, our guides through the many facets of the ayahuasca phenomenon, it's about sensation, about shamanism, about resource management, and about politics. This is part two of In Search of the Divine Vegetal.
What no one can deny is that ayahuasca can be a profound experience. And Len, I respect that you've chosen not to try ayahuasca while we put this together. It provides a balance, but it limits our discussions.
I imagine that it's like talking about sex with a blonde eunuch. But your first-hand knowledge definitely colors your perspective. What was it like, Tom?
Well, this was part of my first experience with ayahuasca. I was sitting there, observing a field of undulating lines, colors, and patterns. It was out there like a movie screen. When in the area between myself and the vision, there appeared a fully three-dimensional hand. I was aware that the hand existed in an alternate space and that it belonged to the shaman, Juan Payama. He was looking at me and sitting about six seatings away. The alternate reality had a full sense of veracity, but it did not displace physical reality. It was simultaneous. I tried to produce a hand in that space as well to give Juan a tap of recognition, but I was unable to do so. So instead, I looked over at him and I gave him a thumbs up with my physical hand. Sometime later, however, he was seated with his apprentice, Carlos Tanner, in front of me. And to the side, this Hindu-looking eyeball with lashes of smaller eyeballs above and below hovered in the space between us. Without thinking, I just produced a hand in that alternate space and guided the eyeball down in front of Carlos's face. And at that point, Juan raised his hand and pushed it into Carlos's forehead. I took the whole episode to be an object lesson from Juan, saying, "Look, this space is here. It has parameters. You can learn to manipulate within it. You share this space with the shaman, and quite often with other people participating in the ceremony." It was like lucid dreaming. It wasn't chaotic. It was coherent.
I'm still not convinced that it's anything more than an extremely powerful drug trip. Anyway, not everybody experiences a common or shared space like you did.
No, you're right. Not everybody does go to the same place. You go where you need to go. Some people don't even have visions under the influence of ayahuasca. We're highly suggestible creatures, and advertising budgets confirm this. I think that's part of the lesson of ayahuasca. And sure, many commonly seen things can be explained by that. Let's listen to Dennis McKenna's fantastic voyage into the world of photosynthesis.
I'm a plant biochemist or whatever. I mean, I knew in the abstract what the stages of photosynthesis were and what's going on, but this was the virtual reality tour of photosynthesis. It was basically seeing photosynthesis from the standpoint of a water molecule and going through the whole process. But it was more than that. It was just charged with emotion. It was a very moving experience, and it was like I was being shown these things and told these things by ayahuasca, which presented as, you know, kind of like your tour guide or something, you know, speaking over your left shoulder and like, okay, now look at this, and, you know, here's the significance of that. And you know, the basic message of that trip was, you know, you monkeys only think you're running the show, and wake up. And that was it.
What else would Dennis see? He's a scientist, fascinated by plants. I have a friend, James, who owns Storm Brewing. Somebody gave him an ayahuasca mixture without explaining what was going to happen. His vision? Found himself surrounded by elves, lifting large beer steins and chanting, "Cheers! Cheers! Cheers! Cheers!"
Yeah, well, I know your friend James. I'm not surprised that he was visited by elves. He's as much an alchemist as he is a brewer. But he should never have taken ayahuasca uninformed and without serious preparation. Yet his experience does, however, hint at another ayahuasca phenomenon. Here, Alan Shoemaker, Jacques Mabit, and researcher John Hauser all tell us about their encounters with some kind of autonomous intelligence.
Well, when I looked up, the plants all around me were full of spirits, right, and they were glowing from the inside out, and that's where the light came from. The smaller plants were children, and plants about 5-6 feet tall were older juveniles, and the two in front of me were like 30 feet tall, and all around me in this semicircle, they all had on these robes in a checkered pattern of lime green, cream, and white with little Nehru collars.
Entonces, yo estaba muy impresionado de esa escena.
They told me they were the guardians of the jungle. At the time, I had no way to reference such a concept. They asked me what I was doing there, what it was that I sought. I told them I wanted to learn this discipline, to understand this medicine and this world. And so they consulted with one another, and the one in the middle said, "Okay, you have been granted permission to enter into this school, and it shall be your path."
Is there something that more than one person can experience independently as a verified sighting? My inclination is the answer to that is yes. And there's one particular experience that I had that really started making me suspect that there could be something like this, which was during a very visionary state of the ayahuasca experience. A tube appeared, came out of I don't know where, it came out of space somewhere, and out of the end of the tube came these articulating threads or tubes of light, and the tubes of light entered my head through my left eye, actually, and made what I experienced as a neurological examination, and went through and seemed to be testing circuits all through the space in my head, which is my skull. And I sensed that there was some sort of procedure happening that was testing circuitry in the interest of healing and in the interest of repairing whatever damage that comes as a result of age-related cognitive decline or whatever you want to call it. And actually, I did notice an increase in cognitive performance, subjectively speaking. And that happened during the same month that a very similar sort of phenomenon was encountered by two other ayahuasca.com forum members.
Ayahuasca.com, an internet portal offering self-enlightenment. Ayahuasca is becoming the experience of choice for the holistic mystical set. These spiritual tourists going down to the Amazon to find a real shaman to sell them self-enlightenment in a cup might be what kills any true relevance and meaning that ayahuasca has. In his presentation at the 3rd Annual Shamanism Conference in Iquitos, Peru, Spanish filmmaker Geronimo Muñoz warns about how dangerous and ignorant this might prove to be.
Well, how are you doing? My name is Geronimo, and for the past 7 years now, I've been filming a documentary that just keeps on growing and growing and growing. Together with a Canadian partner, Mark, who's not here, our cameraman. I felt stupid many times. And I've had to consider once again and again and again the way that certain well-meaning but ignorant forms of interest can actually turn tremendously destructive. And in many cases, our very presence, you know, it's already a powerful imposition. I mean, what you know, this vacation on Gringo with this super powerful currency, you know, that can arrive and everything seems cheap, you know, he's throwing money away, and he's a nice guy, you know, and I'm this I want to make clear, this was me, you know, this was me. So I want to talk a little bit about this, about this process, because I think there's a certain idea that it lives inside our culture, you know, I call Western culture, which derives from, you know, Greek, Judeo-Christian, and it's basically the idea that, it's called the pastoral idea, it's the idea that somewhere else, people live in a state of pure harmony with nature. This idea was actually manifested already in what was called pastoral poetry. Pastoral poetry was Greek poetry from 2,500 years ago. So 2,500 years ago, the Greeks believed, they were already so urban, that they believed that in the mountains of Greece, there were these shepherds, and these shepherds lived a pure life in harmony with nature that was beautiful and pure and simple. Now this idea, this pastoral idea, has shifted and moved and became part of like Western mindset. It revived, you know, during the Romantic period. And then it finally manifested in Rousseau's idea of the noble savage. Rousseau was this guy who had never met any real Indians. But he imagined that these noble savages were actually creatures that were like noble and in perfect harmony with nature. This idea still lives in our heads. This idea is not true. And I think if any of you spend any amount of time searching for this and meeting real curanderos and spending some time with them, sometimes a long time with them, sooner or later you're gonna realize that really, you know, shaman or not shaman, this is really a person. You know, a person that has sometimes problems with his wife, a person that maybe likes to drink so much, a person that knows some things and doesn't know other things. It's certainly not like a, you know, it's no Buddha, it's no Yoda. It's no Yoda.
Okay, well, come on, Len. It's not as if these people are racing down there on the weekend and mugging the first brown guy they see for his ancient and mystical knowledge, you know, before they head back to their day jobs designing pipeline routes for Chevron. If I may speak in broad strokes as well, these are more likely people who went green long before anyone else. They eat organic food, buy locally, and invest ethically, if they have money. They are socially and politically conscious and concerned. But like Martin Prechtel says, the main reason for travel is to realize the poverty of your own culture. Here's Dennis McKenna with a more optimistic view.
I think that most people who are motivated to go to the Amazon and put up with all the inconvenience of going there, they're not thrill seekers, you know. They're pretty sincere people. And the reason that they're there is because they're looking for some spiritual epiphany that our culture is no longer capable of giving them. That's what drove them to go there. I mean, you know, in the 60s, a lot of people went to India and practiced yoga and adopted that whole, another whole set of alien practices. The ayahuasca tourism is no different. I mean, it's basically people are looking outside their own cultural box for something that they are not finding in that box. You know, they have some spiritual longing and they're trying to fill that.
Again, you know, what is at play is like a lack of a basic ability to see people as people, you know. For example, imagine that, I don't know, that your father is somewhere in Texas, they're making this up, a cowboy, old style cowboy, that means he runs with cows, you know, and he has some horses and he takes them up and down and all of this. And, you know, and he's got some kids, and, you know, they got, like, radio and TV, and they like hip-hop, and they got, like, hats on backwards and stuff, and, yeah, cowboys, okay, but, you know, okay. And sometimes the guy is a little bit of a pain in the ass when he starts talking again about the horses and all of this, you know. And then one day, in your doorstep, shows up a millionaire German. Young guy, speaks the language a little bit badly, you know. He has a lot of money, seems to have a lot of time, and he's fascinated with cowboys, and he wants to learn, he wants to be a cowboy. He wants to be a cowboy, and he's looking at the father like a real cowboy, like, wow, and everything that the father does is like, wow, double wow, and, you know. So, I mean, at some point or another, you know, the father is going to get like, well, let me tell you a thing or two about cowboys. And so this guy starts to hang around. And okay, you know, he's nice and he's got money, but then at the same time, he's a little bit weird, you know. He's a little bit weird about his food. He's a little bit weird about the way he speaks. He doesn't really understand everything, you know. And sometimes you even see him like he's giving a little bit of this disapproving look, like he doesn't really approve of like certain things you do and the way you quite get drunk and the way you go about these things and the way you go about these other things. So, I mean, this relationship builds up, or like, okay, the German is here, but okay, it's been like 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and you know what, maybe you start getting a little bit sick of the German. Maybe you start, you know, I mean, I don't have to continue the story. You see how it develops. It's completely normal. It's completely normal. It's difficult. But just imagine that, like, more Germans arrive, and it comes to the point where, like, you know, and on the other hand, this really cowboy lifestyle, was that enough, you know? And there are more Germans coming, and they're now learn to play the ukulele, and they can sing this, like, ukulele music, a little bit with German accent, you know, sounds a little bit strange. And all of a sudden, you know, one of these guys, or maybe even one of the Germans, been many years, has a brilliant idea, because these guys are running around and many of them are having hard time finding real cowboys, and he just like gets the idea, you know. Cowboy school, German spoken, euros accepted, you know, and there you have it.
It's this classic situation of a you know, powerful global culture meeting a very fragile indigenous culture. So what that can lead to, if that goes too far, is they come to devalue their own knowledge. And this is really what we have to be concerned about, especially with the newer generations. We have to somehow teach them that, you know, what they know is valuable in some intangible sense, and it's hard. It's, you know, they see this alien but enticing culture, and, you know, they want those things. I mean, they want iPods, they want televisions, they want all of these things. It seems to be either we're all conditioned by consumer culture to want these things, or maybe it's just a inbuilt human trait that you want the shiny things, you know, and you want the things that symbolize the glamorous life, you know. And I don't really know. You cannot fence these cultures off into reservations. You can't prevent them from coming in contact with global culture. I mean, even shamans have websites now.
Native groups from the Amazon are making alliances with Westerners in order to defend their traditional territories from resource development and devastation. But it does change the practice and their economy.
Curanderos, they almost never were basically just curanderos. They always had a job, they had a chakra, they grew their own food. I mean, they had something to do. You couldn't, it was hard in small villages to make a living being a curandero. It was just something else that they did. You know, people came for them to get cured, they did what they could, and if it worked, it worked, and if it didn't work, it didn't work. That's what it was. And this is not shamanism, this is traditional medicine. This is the way it was. You went to the doctor, you know, if he could cure you, okay, he had another job. Now, when we, the gringos, start to arrive, a new type of situation arises where basically some people can afford to be nothing but curanderos because we pay so well. The problem is that when you're nothing but a curandero and you're living off the money of the gringos, then a commerce relationship had been established, and they are clients, they're customers, and the customer is always right, and the customer gets what he wants because the customer is paying. So all of a sudden you're in a situation where certain things that wouldn't normally fly have to fly, because this guy is going to give you, in for one evening, five times the amount of money that you would make working in a week, maybe. You know, that's how it goes. So then, this very thing that fascinates us, and this very thing that we want to protect, and this very thing that we want to, like, maintain alive, and that seems to be in danger, we are actually, by our interest and by our influx of money, we're slowly eroding.
Inherent in Hieronymo's critique is our insatiable appetite for personal self-enlightenment. After 500 years of the pursuit of personal freedom, the most important thing some people can find to do with the gift of self-determination is to gaze at their own navels. Rosa Nakazawa is gentle in her admonition to consider the depths and origins of the centuries-old practice.
In the case of taking ayahuasca, what some Westerners consider to be an exercise in personal freedom actually amounts to a lack of respect for traditional people and their technology. Ritual reminds us that when we ingest these plants, there is a whole tradition operating behind this practice. It contains knowledge we haven't even begun to apprehend, and which can only be gained experientially. As we acquire a deeper appreciation for the richness of this tradition and all it has to teach, we become more aware of the importance of not trying to reduce or condense this knowledge base, because if we do so, important elements will inevitably be lost. To my way of thinking, the biggest threat to traditional medicine is first and foremost commercialization.
There was a paper put out a few years ago that asked the question, what is the value of undiscovered pharmaceuticals in the rainforest? It's very hard to put a price on what you haven't discovered, but with a lot of hand-waving and estimating and this kind of thing, reasonable and conservative assumptions, they were able to say, you know, there are approximately 328 blockbuster drugs still waiting to be discovered in the world's tropical rainforest. And each one, after the cost of development, would be worth $100 million to the company, and worth, of course, much more than that to the societies and the patients and people that benefit from that medicine. So there are attempts to put a value on it. You know, this has come up specifically with respect to ayahuasca. You know, there was a company in the early 80s that filed a patent on ayahuasca. And it was a ridiculous patent in that it was totally undefendable, but it was, they filed a patent on it. And a group of curanderos, mostly from Ecuador, came to the United States and petitioned the patent office and said, basically, you know, this is our sacred medicine, and we've known for thousands of years about all this, and you guys need to overturn this patent. And they did. And, you know, I mean, I'm all for drug discovery, and I'm all for utilizing these resources to make everybody's lives better. You can't say a particular indigenous group owns these things any more than, you know, Monsanto does. They're really the common heritage of everyone. And it's a very delicate thing, because on the one hand, you don't want to just throw it wide open and make it possible for these multinational corporations to exploit all of these things and make billions of dollars without giving anything back. But then you can overreact the other way, and this is what's happened lately, is as governments wake up to this, they make it so difficult for anybody to do any kind of research that none of this stuff gets investigated, and so nobody benefits. Not the indigenous people, not the first world, nobody.
In terms of what might constitute appropriate compensation to indigenous groups for the use of their plant knowledge, the bottom line is that benefits must be shared. If there are material benefits, those should be shared, but so should other benefits, moral, ethical, social, and otherwise. A big piece would be to raise the standard of living of the common person and provide them with such things as access to technology, resources, education, and health care. We live in a global community and need to be aware of our interconnectedness so that we do not impose unrealistic or unattainable values or conditions upon others. For instance, environmental norms are meaningless to someone who can barely earn enough to eat and works as a tree cutter to send his kids to school. Some of the most valuable traditional knowledge is transmitted by people who live in communities with no clean water to drink and where waterborne diseases and other afflictions of poverty are rampant. There are such huge disparities in Peru that it is not meaningful to talk about exchange until some of these inequities are redressed.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on CBC.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. Filmmaker Tom McKinnon and writer Leonard Clare Cunningham team up to take us in search of the divine vegetal. Communities in the Amazon are not as isolated as they once were, and it's not the impact of exotic travel devotees that worries them. Resource-based industries like oil and mining have also discovered the Amazon, and they want to stay.
The indigenous shamans struggle to have the effectiveness of their natural medicines recognized in the treatment of disease, and with their culture and land now threatened as never before, have begun organizing in response.
Pues bueno, mi nombre es Fidel Antigrefa.
My name is Fidel Antigrefa, and I'm from the Quechua Nation, from the city of Tena, province of Napo, Ecuador. I represent an association of indigenous shamans from the Napo region of Ecuador. This organization has been a legal entity for the last 10 or 12 years and grew out of the need to address a considerable amount of discrimination in the region. Curanderos were being persecuted by the law, which was making it difficult to do their work and to practice their profession, which encompasses both natural medicine and spirituality. Due to this systemic devaluation, we were in danger of losing our culture. Part of our mandate is to recover our own identity by maintaining our customs. Since one of our principal customs is the use of natural medicine to cure illness, especially in the absence of doctors. This is my goal, to work towards the political recognition of our right to practice our spirituality and medicine, and to preserve and employ ancestral traditions. The Amazon represents the lungs of the world, and multinational corporations, most notably the petroleum industry, have arrived to exploit the resources of our territory. They've already destroyed vast tracts of rainforest, which has caused the loss of habitat and subsequent death of many species of fish and animals. To us, this represents a destruction of our medicine as well, for medicine resides in all the jungle. It's in all the plants, all the animals, all the fish. In its extraction of crude oil, the petroleum industry is causing irretrievable losses to the environment. Our organization of Curanderos is trying to prevent further damage to our rivers and forests by being a voice calling for an end to this destruction so that our lives, knowledge, wisdom, and culture may be preserved.
How do you feel about the sharing of traditional knowledge with other countries?
This is possible, but not without adequate remuneration. Those with the expertise need to be able to support themselves and their families, and to be able to continue to practice their profession. There is a cost involved to teaching, and these experts, through years of practice, learning, and diet, make a great sacrifice in order to acquire this knowledge. This must be recognized, valued, and compensated accordingly. Curanderos cannot reasonably be expected to provide this free of charge. No one expects conventional doctors to work for free. We simply ask that you be aware of this and provide a fair economic incentive so that we may continue to maintain and pass on this ancestral knowledge through teaching, setting up schools, and so forth.
Do you think that there are Westerners who come here to acquire knowledge and skills to take back to their lands without thinking about the importance of making an appropriate contribution or exchange?
A few do have this awareness, but many come just to obtain the technology for the purpose of commercialization and their own enrichment. They have no interest in what we're trying to do or preserve on a systematic level. And many times they'll offer their teacher a piece of clothing or perhaps a meal. They take back this valuable information and knowledge and prosper by it, with scarcely a thought for the poor, humble, illiterate country folk upon whose backs their riches are built. I don't really know what words to put to this, except to say that they've already conquered us in one way, and now they're back to conquer the rest. They've exploited all they can in one sense, and now they're back for more.
Ayahuasca has already left the Amazon. You can buy the ingredients over the internet or purchase it at the counter of your local urban shaman shop. I'm not sure the divine and sacred meaning of ayahuasca will survive the journey. Check out this clip I found on YouTube, a bunch of teenagers taking ayahuasca in their living room.
That shit is gross.
Don't throw up, don't throw up. Damn you guys.
Oh my god, it is the devil's bile.
Man, I really don't think that was as bad as I was expecting, though.
It was bad. It like mixed with the peanut butter, so like I had to get rid of the peanut butter before.
Really? You know what? It really was that lemon juice that made it all sour and nasty, man. Alright, 750 is the... Hey, will you pass that Coke on me?
I feel so weird.
You feel weird?
I haven't drank one yet.
I honestly wonder how strong the trip is going to be.
Here, give me more peanut butter, man. Ugh.
See, that's what I didn't want to do. Two coats of peanut butter and wait for the second shot. It
sucks. An hour.
I'm trying to
hold down.
Are you throwing up? Really?
Well, that's not like right here.
Well, you did it all at once, too.
I don't have a lot of hallucinogen experience.
Oh geez, this is all gonna be a really long hour.
Really? You already feel sick?
Yeah. I don't feel sick, I can just feel it in my belly already. Someone put on like the Simpsons or something, man.
So, are you okay with Homer Simpson as a manifestation of the divine collective unconscious?
Well, we don't see the culmination of the trip, but I don't doubt that ayahuasca herself would soon purge them of their flippancy. It's not a joyride, although I think there is room for humor. In all seriousness, though, Homer Simpson could represent an archetype of the fool. That's familiar from Jungian psychology. The relationship between ayahuasca and the unconscious may explain why it has been so readily accepted by the adherents of transpersonal psychology. Dr. Jessica Rochester is a psychologist and teacher. She provides us with a short history of the development of transpersonal psychology.
If we speak about the unconscious, we can see that Jung's maps were the first Western or European maps that were developed of the self, going from the individual I to the collective, what he termed the collective unconscious. Then there's the Italian psychiatrist, Roberto Saggioli, again another colleague of both Freud and Jung, but who went a step further in his development of the map of the self. He included the individual spiritual experience as it relates to the divine. Now, the next steps after that would have been through the 50s, let's say, and with the humanistic psychologies. Psychologists were starting to see people who would come in and say, you know, hi, you know, I'm the president of the ABC company, and I've got my car and my wife and my home and my pool and my villa and my everything, and I feel empty. And they were starting to see a lot of this, and they were calling it existential neurosis. So the humanistic psychologies were sort of expanding their maps to include creativity and, you know, sort of expanding a little bit into the area of spirituality. And then the great teacher, Dr. Stanislav Grof, through the late 50s, his work of mapping the non-ordinary states of consciousness has perhaps been the best step in organizing the principles of understanding how we relate as individuals to our unconscious. Most people consider themselves Newtonian objects, skin encapsulated egos. That is not the transpersonal map of the human being. We believe that we are energetic beings who are incarnating in a physical body, but one that is in continuous transformation, not only with the air we breathe, the food we eat, but in contact with everything around us.
That description of the transpersonal realm does sound a lot like some of the ayahuasca experiences we've heard. And even in the West, people have chosen to attribute them to contact with the divine. They've formed churches, like the Santo Daime, for instance.
Jessica Rochester's transpersonal practice led her to become a madrina of the Seo de Montreal chapter of the Santo Daime Church.
Since I was a child, I've had spiritual experiences, some of them very profound and life-formative, and I began exploring and developing myself with spiritual and religious practices. And a series of synchronicities later led me to my trainings in the transpersonal psychologies. And it was through my meeting with Dr. Stan Groff that I decided to go to Brazil 11 years ago. There was the International Transpersonal Association Conference in Manaus, Brazil. So post-conference, took a plane and then a smaller plane and a smaller plane and then got in a boat and went 12 hours in a dugout canoe up the Amazon, up the Igarapes to a small community, which is the Mecca of the Santo Daime, called Mapia. In one of the rituals in the rainforest, I had a profound remembering experience that connected many of my spiritual experiences in a way that made sense. So that led me to coming home, sharing with my friends, and the next thing I knew I had a church.
Alex Pilari is an elder of the Brazilian Syncretic Church, which blends African, Indigenous, and Catholic traditions.
Although the Santo Daime emerged from the traditional use of ayahuasca among the indigenous people of the Amazon, and indeed had roots extending even further back to the Incan people, in reality, these people and their practices had been massacred by colonialism, masquerading as Christianity. The original message of Jesus had been lost in the process, and this had taken a huge toll on the native people. What Mestre Irineu did was to rescue a Christian doctrine which had been severely distorted. By recognizing the worth of the very people who had been decimated, and integrating the wisdom of their sacred beverage, a new formulation regarding the teachings of Christ was revealed. What Mestre Irineu re-identified and reaffirmed was the original primitive seed of Christianity, a new vision for Christianity emerging from the native forest, one based on the insights, ancestry, and sacred drink of the very people who had been subjugated by this colonial enterprise in the guise of Christianity. When Mestre Irineu received his mission in the forest, ayahuasca was transformed into the consecrated Daime, and its name comes from the words Daime, which means give me. Give me faith, give me healing, give me what I require. Our doctrine is inclusive of indigenous cosmology because it is an expression of the divine force of creation, which is present in all things. It is a universal message, independent of any region or cultural context. It has Christian underpinnings, but is capable of awakening and opening the spiritual aspect of any person in a manner that is appropriate to them.
These more recent, what you might call more syncretic religions, in which I would include the Native American Church and some of the religions in Brazil that have appeared in the 20th century, at which ayahuasca is at the center of their practice as a sacrament, now they're migrating out into the world, and they still use these plant-based, essentially indigenous sacraments. And that comes up against the whole, you know, regulatory structure of drug regulation, both on the medical side and the whole war on drugs and all this. You know, at what point do the interests of the state in prohibiting access to harmful and dangerous substances, you know, at what point do those interests collide with people's right to religious freedom?
Dimethyltryptamine is one of the active ingredients in ayahuasca, or daime, and it is a controlled substance under Canadian law. Jessica Rochester has been working for the last 6 years to have the legal right to use the daime sacrament in Canada.
After 5 years, which is now 6 years ago, I applied to the Canadian government for an exemption under Section 56 of the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act to be able to have our religion recognized and legalized. Because we work with the sacrament, the plant teachers, it was essential for us to gain the exemption with the Canadian government. The Canadian government has been doing a very thorough research of the religion itself, health and safety of members or visitors. Now, this all follows on the research that the Brazilian government did for more than 50 years, which included anthropological and medical, psychological, every aspect of examining the cultures and the communities to see if the people were healthy or if there was any reason why the sacred plant use should be discontinued. What they found in Brazil was that people in the communities are very healthy, very conscious, and very connected to community, nature, and the divine. So the Canadian government has examined all of this, and right now we await some documents from Brazil. We're awaiting export permission from Brazil. So once that is complete, then we probably are in a position to be able to practice our religion here in Canada.
We forget that science was born from and relies upon the same thing that motivates many people's fascination with ayahuasca: amazement and wonder, a desire to understand things that seem to be just beyond our grasp. There's plenty of evidence that the Gnostics probably used mushrooms to facilitate religious visions. Soma occupied a central role in the Indo-Aryan religion. In Greek history, the Oracle of Eleusis most likely relied on a beer type of beverage made from ergotized barley, and ergo is the fungus from which LSD is derived.
As people seek after ecstasy and peace and harmony, and so we should. However, the shadow experiences are much more difficult ones. That's where we see the unattractive aspects of ourselves and the mean, the stingy, the cowardly parts of ourselves that we don't want to look at and don't want other people to see. Now, when we drink daime and when we practice on our spiritual path, we come face to face with those aspects of ourselves. We cannot ignore them or deny them. We must face them. By so doing, we are taking the hero's journey, much what Joseph Campbell spoke about, in the ability to get on our horse and to go through the dark woods and face whatever is there.
Perhaps we've reached the limits of what science can provide us, or at least a recognition that there are some things or needs that it simply cannot answer or fulfill. If there is a zeitgeist to our age, it's that we're at some culmination, some pivotal point, and we are not sure where we are going or what is going to happen.
We live in the time of the fulfillment of two very interesting ancient prophecies. East meets West as the fulfillment of a Buddhist prophecy that said when the iron bird flies, then Buddhism will move west. That, of course, being the airplane, and the 500-year-old prophecy of the Mayans, who said that after the white man comes, and they hadn't seen them yet, then there will be 500 years of suffering, after which there will be an awakening in which the eagle and the condor will dance together. But we have to understand that sacred plants and non-ordinary states of consciousness have been used by all cultures throughout the world for millennia upon millennia. This particular sacrament has been used for 6,000 years at least in recorded in the Amazonic basin. And we can peel back every great religion and keep peeling it back, and you come to shamanism. And shamanism is based on the individual having their own experience with the divine, their own connection with nature, with community, and with themselves.
One thing I can say about the UDV and these other churches, I mean, they may have doctrinal issues, and you know, they're not, you know, they have problems, and I think every organized religion has problems, but what they have going for them, that as far as I can tell, Western religions may once have had, but don't have anymore, is they have a real mystery in their midst, and they have a tremendum that they are close to. And this makes the difference. This is the touchstone, and it keeps them from becoming estranged from nature and from rejecting biology, in a sense. They're forced to integrate it because, you know, they worship a drug which induces ecstasy. Well, ecstasy is a very threatening thing to the Western religious tradition.
It may be that the traditional world of the shaman is disappearing, but the practice of shamanism is also evolving and informing people worldwide. Perhaps in a global world, what is required is a global community consciousness. New practices, new rituals, new communities are being forged, like at Goa, Burning Man, or even ayahuasca.com. After all, traditions aren't discovered, they're made. Some believe it's time for the cultures of the heart to speak and be heard by the Western cultures of the mind, so that among us, a sustainable future for all can evolve. Rak Rizam provides eloquent testimony about this changing global culture.
I think I've been drawn here to become part of the global ayahuasca culture that's developing. I've come from previous ethnogenic cultures, party culture, doof culture background. I think culture goes in waves of history. Like, history is like the shock waves of this thing that we're coming up towards. And you see it like on the internet and ayahuasca forums and tribal communities like cyber tribes of people of like mind finding the others and amalgamating, coming together. And I feel now ayahuasca is working on the blockage of the soul. And it's so not a drug. It's a consciousness. It's a spirit. It's your lover. It's a relationship you develop with the plant and the spirit in the plant. And if you quiet and listen and empty and open, you'll hear the spirit. And the first few times, it's getting to know you and it's going, oh, what's this human? As we're opening up, it's reading us. And those thoughts, it's reading through the book of us. And it's knowing us and where our problems are and what needs to be fixed. There's definitely a spirit consciousness in it. It's not Hollywood. It's so not the Hollywood visions. It's not the Hollywood drug. It's not take the red pill and go into the matrix every time, same spot. It's like you have to work at it. And you're working at you. You're working at all your blockages you never knew were there, or maybe you did. And ayahuasca's helping you overcome them. It's not the practitioner. It's not the shaman. It's not the brew. It's not the you. It's the you and the brew and the shaman. It's when you're ready. And when the blockages are gone, the levels open up and the jaguar flutter by, the spirit world opens, and it's the spirit world. It's a deep, deep pool of being.
One of the things working, I think, to head off disaster is that people are rediscovering these alliances with plants and forming their own shamanic practices, which may borrow from indigenous practice, may be made up on the spot, may borrow from a lot of different syncretic sources. Doesn't really matter. You know, the important thing is that they create a context in which they can make this connection with the plant and have this communication and have these experiences and learn what the plants have to teach. Whether you do it in your living room in Vancouver or you're hot in the Amazon, or it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that you make the connection and you are open enough to listen and learn. I think it's incumbent on us to, you know, live this life in the here and now with joy and gratitude and in a respectful way, in a sacred way. I think gratitude and appreciation are really what we need, you know, what we're lacking in this culture. And, you know, ayahuasca reminds you very, very forcefully how important that is, you know, just to be grateful for being here and being alive. I mean, if you think about it, that's just a pretty unlikely thing right there.
Ayahuasca. Tu amor toca mi corazón. Tu fidelidad pasa las nubes del firmamento. Tu humildad me eleva más arriba que las altas lupunas del Amazonas. Tu sabiduría es inalcanzable, Dios mío. Tus hijos se abrigan bajo la sombra de tus hojas. Se alimentan de la dulzura de tu pócima y se embriagan en el torrente de tus visiones. Ayahuasca, tú me sabes.
In Search of the Divine Vegetal was prepared and narrated by Leonard Clare Cunningham and Tom McKinnon, with translation assistance from Yasmin Grant. The documentary acquired some footage from a video series on psychoactive plants that Tom and Len are developing with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Len and Tom are also collaborating on a television documentary on Aboriginal deaths in police custody. It'll be broadcast in the fall of 2009. Thanks to CBC staff Paul Grant, Todd Elvidge, Heather Brown, and Paolo Pietropaolo for lending their voices. Technical assistance was provided by Chris Cutress. The producer in Vancouver was Kathleen Flaherty. If you'd like an audio copy of this or any other Ideas program, if you want to know what's coming up on the show, or if you'd like to learn more about CBC podcasting, just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.
Inyo no, inyo no, inyo no.